Shabbos, as we know, is clearly something that is extremely significant in the context of the entirety of Torah. Just last week, we spoke about the idea that someone who is Mechal Shabbos is Kedino Kofar B'chala Torah Kula. It's as if you are not only showing a lack of respect for Shabbos, but it's something that has much more far-reaching implications. In fact, Shabbos is mentioned so many times throughout the pages of Chumash. The very first time we speak about Shabbos is by Sheshisimei Bereishis and Parshas Bereishis, when the Torah talks about, this is no more comfortable, when the Torah talks about creating the world, so Shabbos is obviously listed in that discussion as well. In Sefer Shemos, Shabbos plays a prominent role over and over and over again. First of all, in Parshas B'Shalach, when we are given the instruction about the man falling down, and when we're told that on Shabbos we're not going to have the opportunity to have man, and that's why on Friday everyone, everyone had to prepare adequately on Friday in order to be ready for that which was going to not happen on Shabbos. The Torah talks about it again in our Parsha, in Parshas Yisro, and then once again in the end of Parshas Mishpatim. In Parshas Kisisa, after the Chet HaEgel, the Torah describes the observance of Shabbos once again. And then in Vayakel, when the Torah gives us the description about how to build a Mishkan, we are once again reminded about this idea of how important Shabbos is. In Vayikra, in Bamidbar, in Devarim, the story of Shabbos comes up over and over again. I think if you count it, it seems to be at least 15 times that the Torah talks about what the experience of Shabbos is all about. The challenge is what the Gemara says in Maseches Chagiga. The Gemara tells us that Hilchos Shabbos is one of the areas of Halacha, as the Gemara coins it, is Kehararim Hatluyim Bisara, which means it's like a mountain that's hanging by a thread, which obviously doesn't have a very strong foundation. If a mountain is hanging by a thread, sometimes it can tip over. So the Gemara says that Shabbos, that's the image that we conjure up in our minds when we talk about Shabbos. In what way? Says the Gemara, Shehen Mikra Muat V'Halachos Merubos. When you go through the details, the expansive nature, the comprehensive, wide-ranging halacha that Shabbos encompasses, you realize that as you read through the Pesukim and Chumash, none of that appears. And you see that there's a major discrepancy between the very small description of how to observe Shabbos in the pages of Chumash and the way that the Shulchan Aruch outlines it for us today. So that is something that the Gemara says is going to present us a major challenge, because after all, we don't really have so many Pesukim and Chumash that tell us exactly how we are supposed to observe Shabbos. Interestingly, the Torah does make mention of four specific melachos in particular. So we know that there are 39 general categories of melacha on Shabbos, of activities on Shabbos that one is not allowed to do. They are not outlined in Chumash. They are not mentioned. There are four exceptions to the rule. There are four different activities that are mentioned explicitly in Chumash. What are those four? So first of all, we have a pasuk in Sefer Shmos, Perek Lamed Daled, pasuk Chaf Aleph. The Torah says, Sheshes Yamim Ta'avod, you should work for 6 days, and Vayom Hashvi Tishbos, as the seventh day you should rest, Becharish Uvakatsir Tishbos. What does that mean? It means you should rest on the seventh day. But in particular, the Torah says, Becharish Uvakatsir Tishbos. Choresh means plowing. Katsir means harvesting. So the Torah says, you're not allowed to plow, and you're not allowed to harvest on Shabbos. What about everything else? Those are the only things that are not permitted on Shabbos. Why does the Torah go out of its way to say that when you're resting on Shabbos, you have to make sure that you don't do the activity of Charisha, which is plowing, and Katsira, which is harvesting? What is unique about those two? And the answer that the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra and Chumash explain is that when we talk about these two activities, especially in the days of the Jewish people living not like we have today, where we have so many different professions, the main profession back then was somebody who worked the fields. And what the Torah is emphasizing here is, even though Choresh and Kotzer, harvesting and working my field, are the most essential and basic necessities for a person's parnasa, even though this is my only source of income, even though this is my only livelihood, this is my only employment, still, the Torah says that I am not allowed to be involved in these activities on Shabbos. Whereas, I would have said, yeah, maybe the Torah says I should take a break from certain things, but that which is most essential to my parnasa, that which my whole life depends on, if I don't have this, I'm not going to have any money, then maybe you would say the Torah obviously makes a dispensation. Says the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra, no, that's why the Torah goes out of its way to list these two. Becharish v'akatzir tishbos, not to the exclusion of anything else, but rather to emphasize that even though these are so much an essential part of our employment and our job and our livelihood, we still are not allowed to engage in those malachos on Shabbos. So that takes care of those two. What are the other two that are mentioned in particular? Anybody know? Havara. So the pasuk says in Sefer Shmos, Perek Lamed Hei, pasuk Gimel. Listen carefully. Lo sivaru eish b'chomosh v'seichem b'yom ha-Shabbos. The Torah says, you're not allowed to light a fire in your home on Shabbos. Now, a few things. Number one, it doesn't make a difference whether it's in your house or somewhere else. Torah doesn't mean to say in your house to the exclusion of another location. You're not allowed to light a fire on Shabbos. Now, when the Torah says, lo sivaru eish b'chomosh v'seichem, there were those who misunderstood that to mean that you're not allowed to have a fire lit in your home at all, even if you don't light it, which means maybe you're not allowed to leave a fire on before Shabbos begins. That is a mistake. We don't believe in that. We believe that the correct interpretation of the pasuk is, lo sivaru eish b'chomosh v'seichem b'yom ha-Shabbos means, on Shabbos itself, you're not allowed to initiate or ignite a fire. But if you had something that was there previously, of course, that would be okay, which is why the Rishonim say, we, who are the traditional Jews, who believe that the interpretation of the pasuk is that you're not allowed to light a new fire on Shabbos, we go out of our way to make sure to have some kind of hot food on Shabbos. HaShabbos Aveda here. Anybody lost a bracelet? We go out of our way to make sure that we always have hot food on Shabbos. Why? Because we want to emphasize that this interpretation of the pasuk is not correct. To say that one is not allowed to have anything hot in their home on Shabbos would not be the correct interpretation. All the Torah means to say is you're not allowed to light or ignite a new fire on Shabbos. That's what the Torah says. Now, what exactly does the Torah intend to teach us by highlighting this prohibition of lo sivaru eish b'chomosh v'seichem? We know that there are 39 categories of activities you're not allowed to do. What is unique about this? So Rabbi Yishmael, in Maseches Sanhedrin Daf Lamed Hei, Rabbi Yishmael has an interesting interpretation where he says, perhaps what the Torah means to say is the following. We know that sometimes, very unusual, but sometimes there could be a member of the Jewish community who is going to be administered capital punishment for doing something wrong under certain conditions. They're going to be punished with capital punishment. What happens if somebody does something like that on Shabbos and now they're deserving of the death penalty? Would we be allowed to kill them on Shabbos? Says Rabbi Shmuel, no, because the Torah says, lo sivaru eish b'chomosh v'seichem. You're not allowed to light a fire beyond HaShabbos. That's a reference to somebody who's going to be killed in a Beis Din. We're not allowed to administer that kind of punishment on Shabbos. A big chiddush. That's what Rabbi Shmuel says. The Rambam quotes it la'alacha. But that's why he says the Torah goes out of its way to teach us this. Yes?
I don't understand how that's connected to killing someone on Shabbos.
Yes, that's a great question. How is that connected to killing someone on Shabbos? So the answer is because sometimes when we kill someone, the Gemara describes exactly how we do it. And the Gemara says you have to heat up like a piece of lead, and you're going to, whatever it is, we don't have to get into the graphic details, but that is the opinion of Rabbi Yishmael and Masechah Sanhedrin, that that's what the Torah means to say. That is obviously not the accepted understanding of what the Pasuk means. What the Pasuk means to say, as the Gemara tells us in Masechah Shabbos, according to Rav Nassan, is that Havara Lechalek Yatzasa, which means, say for example, somebody is observing Shabbos, and it happens to be the seventh day of the week, and they totally forgot that it was Shabbos. And they're involved in all kinds of activities that are not permissible on Shabbos, but they didn't have any recognition that today was Shabbos. So what would we tell them to do? That's what we call a shogeg. I wasn't intentionally breaking Shabbos, I just had no idea. Or, I know that today is Shabbos, and I'm simply not aware of the fact that this is not a permissible activity on Shabbos. So what's the halacha in such a case? What do we do? In the days of a Beis HaMikdash, the Gemara says you would have to bring a karban, right? You would have to bring a sacrifice to get a kapara, to gain an atonement. If you did something on Shabbos inadvertently, not realizing that you were doing something wrong, then you would have to bring a karban to atone for your sin of violating Shabbos. Okay, what happens if over the course of a Shabbos I violate 10 different prohibited activities on Shabbos? And then at the end of Shabbos, somebody comes to me and says, by the way, today is Shabbos. And I say, I can't believe it. Over the course of the day, I was doing this, I was doing that, I was doing the other thing, and it turns out I did 10 different things wrong. How many sacrifices, how many karbanos would I have to bring to the Beis HaMikdash after Shabbos is over? Would you say one? Or would you say 10 for all the different things you did wrong? Well, in the end, I'll say, maybe there's room to argue that I should only have to bring one karban, one sacrifice. Why? Because all I did was violate Shabbos without realizing it. Says the Gemara, no. The fact that the Torah highlights one melacha, one prohibited activity over another, means that each one holds its own place, and each one is considered to be lechalek yasasa. Each of the 39 melachos is considered to be respected on its own. And if somebody violated one, they would have to bring a carbon for that. If somebody violated two or three or four or however many it is, you have to bring a carbon to atone for each one in its own right. And that is why the Torah outlined, that's why the Torah specifically highlights one melacha, to teach us on all the other melachos, that each one is a standalone melacha, and this is not one large category of 39. Meaning, to violate Shabbos doesn't mean you have to violate 39 different prohibitions. To violate Shabbos means, even if you violate one prohibition, that would already be problematic. Okay, so that's why the Torah mentions this in particular. And the fourth that is mentioned outside of the general category of melacha is, anybody know? Hotzah, right? So the Torah talks about Hotzah. What does Hotzah mean? The Torah says you're not allowed to go outside of a certain confines. You're not allowed to go from one kind of confined area to another kind of area. That would be a malacha of Hotzah. You're not allowed to carry something from in the building to outside of the building. Something like that is called Hotzah. Where does the Torah mention that? Perek Tez Zayin and Sefer Shmos Pasuk Chav Tes. Shivu Ish Tachtav Al Yetze Ish Mimakom HaBayom HaShvi'i. The Torah says, like you said, Tchum Shabbos or Hotzah, you're not allowed to carry outside of a certain confined area. Why do we mention that malacha in particular? What's uniquely special about that? Again, we said why plowing and harvesting are mentioned, because that's to teach us, even though my whole parnasa depends on that, I'm still not allowed to do it. We said why the Torah mentions Havara, because we're coming to teach us that each of the 39 melachos holds its own place, and you don't have to violate all to be in violation of Shabbos. Why does the Torah highlight this fourth malacha, which is Hotzah? The answer to that is because, the Gemara explains, Hotzah malacha grua. Most of the other malachas on Shabbos are something that requires effort, something that you do some activity, and there's a result that comes about because of what you're doing. But here, when I do the malacha of Hotzah, it's an uncomplicated activity. It's very basic. It's an effortless activity. And as a result of that, if I'm carrying a tissue in my pocket, why would I say that I should be in violation of any malacha? I'm not doing anything. Nothing's changing from what it was to what it is now. So I go outside with a tissue in my pocket, now I come back into the house, and I'm in the same place where I started. Why should that be defined as a malacha? That's why the Torah has to go out of its way, that Hotzah, which is a malacha grua, Hotzah, which I would say should not even be considered a malacha at all, because I'm not doing anything, nothing's changing in status. I would have said that Hotzah is not to be counted among the malachos. That is why the Torah goes out of its way to say that Hotzah is specifically counted among the malachos, because that is what the Torah designated as one of the 39. Okay, so with that short introduction, now we're going to get into another discussion, and that is, how do we define, how do we actually designate the list of 39 melachos? How do we figure that out? So that is a good question. It's not necessarily determined by something which requires exertion or effort on my part. So for example, someone carries a paperclip across the street. It didn't take them a lot of energy or effort to do that, but yet you're in violation of the malacha of Hotzah, if you go out of your building into the street and come back, even though there was no effort involved. And yet we know that if I'm inside of my house and I pick up a stack of chairs, which requires a tremendous amount of effort, and I just pick it up and put it down and keep picking it up and moving it to the other side of the house, I'm in violation of no malacha at all. So it's not necessarily determined by how much work I'm doing. That's not the way we determine what is considered to be a malacha and what perhaps is not. We know when it comes to the malacha of bishul, which is cooking on Shabbos. So, to reheat or warm up food that was already cooked before Shabbos is not really a problem. Again, you have to do it in certain conditions, but it's not a problem. But to take raw food and to cook it for the first time or to fry it would be a problem. Why? How do you figure out why that should be? Or, another example, if you look in Shulchan Aruch, which maybe we'll get into in a later shiur, if I extend the leaf of the table on Shabbos because I had more company, that's permissible. But if a leg of a table falls off and now I go back and screw it in, that's not allowed. What's the difference? I'm doing the same thing. If I'm extending a table and putting a leaf in, now the table is larger. If a leg of the table falls off and now I put it back on, I'm fixing the table and making it usable. Same way that I was doing something before. So It's very hard to determine, and much of this may sound to us as being somewhat arbitrary and inconsistent. It doesn't seem to always fit a formula. So how are we going to really determine and figure out where the list of formulation of Lamed Tes of 39 melachos actually comes from? Where did this magic number 39 actually come from in the first place? Who said that we really have a cap on the melachos of being 39? So this is a discussion in the Gemara Maseches Shabbos, Daf Mem Tes Amud Beis. The Gemara says that the Tanaim, the Amoraim, we're having a discussion to figure out how many melachos are there on Shabbos. How are we to figure out how many categories of prohibited activities there are throughout the duration of Shabbos? And the Gemara says there are 39. Now, how do we know there are 39? Says the Gemara, Keneged Avodas HaMishkan. What does Keneged Avodas HaMishkan mean? Means we look at which activities were necessary to have a functioning Mishkan, which was built in the days that the Jews were traveling in the desert. And from there, we learn to how to observe Shabbos in our times. What's the connection? We'll see in a minute. But why should there be any connection at all? In fact, the Medrash writes, if you look through Parshas Vayakel, which is the Parsha that gives us all of the instructions about building the Mishkan, there you will notice that there are 39 different times that Moshe Rabbeinu is instructed to do this or to do that or to do this activity. So the same way Moshe Rabbeinu was told 39 different times, this is exactly what you should do and this is how you should do it, so therefore we have 39 categories of Malacha as well. Interesting. Sounds arbitrary. Sounds strange. Sounds like it has nothing to do with Shabbos. So how do you figure out what exactly is the intrinsic connection between this idea of building the Mishkan and the idea of our observance of Shabbos, which parenthetically, there is a discussion in the Sefer Egle Tal, which is written by the Avnei Nezer. When we say that we pattern all of the prohibitions of Shabbos based off of what was done in the Mishkan, does that mean off of what was done in the construction of the Mishkan? Everything that needed to be done in order to have a Mishkan built? Or does that mean in the day-to-day of having a functioning Mishkan, there were all kinds of activities that needed to be done also? So how do we learn it? And he gives a whole bunch of distinctions, whether you believe it's this way or the other way, which we don't have to get into now, but what you generally see is that we have some kind of very resonant connection between Shabbos and the Melechas HaMishkan, and all that was necessary to have the Mishkan functioning or being built properly. Now, what is that connection? In fact, in Parshas Vayakel, when the Torah instructs us about building the Mishkan, the Torah, before telling us to build a Mishkan, as a prelude, as an introduction, the Torah says, all the laws of Shabbos. Then, as an epilogue, after the whole discussion of the Mishkan is finished, and all the details of exactly how to do everything, once again, the Torah repeats it as almost like a completion of the building in the Mishkan. We're told the following, Ach es shabsosai tishmoru, umigdashi tiro ani Hashem. What does that mean? Rashi explains. Ach es shabsosai tishmoru, umigdashi tiro. Migdashi tiro means, now that I have a Beis HaMikdash, now that I have a Mishkan that was built, everyone should be careful to behave and act properly in that sacred space. What is es shabsosai tishmoru? Rashi says in the name of the Gemara that what it means is that even though one of the most important primary values in Jewish life is to have a Beis HaMikdash, that's the home of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but yet, as exalted and sublime as it is, Shabbos is even greater. That's what the Torah says. And the Torah is teaching us that if building a Mishkan is going to require you to violate Shabbos in doing so, then you're not allowed to do that. You have to put the Mishkan aside, you have to make the Mishkan wait, and you have to make sure not to do any of that work on Shabbos itself. Now that reminds me of another Gemara, where the Gemara says a very similar sentiment. Imagine if any of us were asked today, you know, you're very artistic, or you're very skilled with your hands, or you know how to do something very well. We're about to build a Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, Mashiach has arrived, and we're now prepared to do everything necessary to have a functioning home for our HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the world. Now, we know that you here in Stern College are extremely talented, and you are the group of people that know how to do everything that needs to be done. So we'd like to recruit you to please come to Yerushalayim and build a Beis HaMikdash. Obviously, all of us would drop whatever we were doing, and we would come and do whatever needs to be done. However, says the Gemara, there is an exception to that rule. Who's the exception? Which group of people would we say, if they were asked to stop everything else they were doing and come to help us in the effort to build a Beis HaMikdash? Not in theory, not Machon HaMikdash, like maybe someday they'll use this and maybe they won't. I don't know. I'm talking about if Mashiach is here and he actually calls someone on the phone and says, you know, I've heard all about you and I think you can really help us out. Can you please come immediately to Yerushalayim? Who would say no, justifiably? Who would say no to Mashiach in that effort? Anybody knows? Gemara says in Megillah. Someone learning Torah? No. No. Tinoka Shavei Sirava. Tinoka Shavei Sirava. The Gemara says that we would not be Mevatel Torah of Tinoka Shavei Sirava in order to build a Beis HaMikdash. Shows you the power of children. Tinoka Shavei Sirava means young children who are learning Torah. We would not stop them from learning Torah in order to build a Beis HaMikdash. That means, as important as a Beis HaMikdash is, and as much of a value as it is to our entire community, to men, women, and children, and even to non-Jews, ki beisi beis tefila yikari l'chol ha'amim, which means that Beis HaMikdash is a place that was made for everyone, for all nations of the world. But yet, a child who's learning, who's being given a Jewish education, is considered to be an even greater value as far as we are concerned. Anyway, I just think that's interesting. So here, I'm reminded of it, because Rashi says that although Shabbos is something that is very important and Beis HaMikdash is very important, when you have the two of those clash, when you have two conflicting values, the importance of Shabbos versus the importance of the Beis HaMikdash, Shabbos will take precedence. Shabbos is considered to be even more important, which makes you wonder, is that really true? That Shabbos always overrides Beis HaMikdash? Anybody know an example where it's not true?
They bring Karbanos
on Shabbos. What does the Torah say? Parshas Pinchas, the Torah says, and for those who want to space out, now is a good time to do it, because this is not relevant. The Torah in Parshas Pinchas says that, Uvayom HaShabbos Shnei Chvasim B'nei Shana Tmimim. We quote this, we say it in our davening every Shabbos, that on Shabbos, they used to bring their karbanos every single week. So doesn't that show us that, obviously, Shabbos does not always override Beis HaMikdash? There are times when Beis HaMikdash overrides Shabbos. Just an interesting question to consider. No? Anyone following? Interesting? It's a good question. It's a good question. What is the answer? We'll have to think about it. I gotta think a little. My wife says that it's really not nice that I do that in a shiur all the time. But my response to her is people keep coming back. So obviously it works. They think maybe in the next year I'm gonna answer the question, which I never ever do. But they still think that I'm waiting to give the answer. So it is a tactic. Just saying. Yes? Offering a karban would be breaking Shabbos because you're killing an animal. You're not allowed to kill on Shabbos. You're not allowed to do all those activities on Shabbos, and yet we do it anyway. So how can we do it? So what would that look like? Preparing the karban before would mean slaughtering it before Shabbos begins and then offering it on Shabbos itself? Well, there would be all kinds of activities that would be prohibited on Shabbos itself, like lighting a fire on the Mizbeach and burning it and cooking and all the different things would also be prohibited. Should have been prohibited, but it's not. We do allow it.
But it's not necessarily that Beis HaMikdash is being prioritized more than serving Hashem during Shabbat. they
think that's the answer. I think that's the answer. When you think about it carefully, I think that really is the way we have to go to find the answer. That it's not that the Beis HaMikdash is more prioritized or overrides Shabbos in that case. It's serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, serving God, overrides Shabbos. And if the way to serve Him is by doing this, then that's what we do. Right? The ultimate goal that we all have is to serve God. Now, He's the one who makes the rules of how we're supposed to do it. If I think that the greatest service to Him, I remember there was a woman in Yerushalayim, I don't know if any of you remember her. Maybe she passed away before you all got to Israel, I don't know. But there was a woman, I'm not saying this in the negative, there was a woman who walked around in Shari Chesed. She was very well known. She was called the Yellow Lady. Anyone ever met the Yellow Lady, right? So she was quite literally the Yellow Lady. You looked at her, and she always wore yellow hat, a flary hat with yellow shoes and yellow stockings and yellow clothing. Everything was yellow. Why? I don't know. Somebody told her many years ago that the way she's going to bring Shefa into the world, the way she's going to bring goodness into the world, religiously, spiritually, is if she always wears yellow. Who told her that? Some idiot, probably. But okay, she believed it, and she really went with that her whole life. And she was like so l'shem shamayim about it. She was like so dedicated to the cause, and she knew that everybody was laughing at her, and she knew that she looked ridiculous, but like, this is what she believed was her tafkid. Okay. So I always wonder, so la'achar me'eva esrim shana, what happens to the Yellow Lady? She comes upstairs, and God says to her, like, I'm really sorry. Again, I don't know this person, I'm not saying anything about her in particular, but like, take a variation of that person, right? So, you have the blue man, I don't know, let's make him up. And like La'achar me'avas shana, he comes up and he has a conversation. God says to him, you know, I really appreciate like all of your wonderful effort to embarrass yourself your whole life, to wear blue all the time and like always stick out. But like, this actually meant absolutely nothing to me. Like, what happens? Like, there was absolutely no mashmos to what you did. There was zero value to anything you did. And like, I appreciate the thought, but like, it was just totally not, it did nothing. Like, what happens? Right? We don't choose to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu however we think it makes sense to do so. Right? If I think it makes sense to shake a lulav on Hanukkah, I get no credit for that. Even though I feel very spiritual about it, and I feel that I'm connecting, and you can feel whatever you want. But if that's not what God told you to do, then you what value does it have? Then what value does it have? So I think this is just a general question. We always need to ask ourselves, what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want us to do? What is the best way to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu based on his expectations, based on how he would like us to serve him, not on how we choose to decide to serve him, which is sometimes hard for us, and it's difficult. I don't know. Anyone else? Am I crazy? Am I the only one who's thought about such a thing? Like, what happens to people who are... You know, I actually thought about it after I met with a Reform rabbi, right? So, when you think about it, a Reform rabbi is destroying Judaism. Bottom line, they're encouraging people to intermarriage. They'll be Masada Kedushin at a marriage that's a Jew and a non-Jew. Like, that's destroying Yiddishkeit, right? But I'm sure many of them, or most of them, or all of them, I don't know, are the Shem Shamayim. They went to rabbinical school. They gave up their lives to do, you know, God's work. They're just misguided, right? So they don't know what we know. They have a different set of values. They follow a Torah that's not authentic. So what happens? A person gives his whole life, her whole life, whoever, a man, a woman, whoever it is, gives their whole life to the community in that way. And then the Acher Meiv Esam Shana comes to the realization, like, oh my gosh, I was playing for the wrong team. I can't believe it. Like, I was actually pushing Jews away from Judaism instead of toward God. What happens? Did they actually get no credit? Now, this keeps me up at night, actually. This is like something that bothers me. Anyway, I don't know what it has to do with this question, but so what is the understanding of this clear connection that we have between the building of the Mishkan and Shabbos itself? What is the connecting thread between the two of them? What I think the answer is that there's a tremendous similarity. What was the objective of building a Mishkan? The point of building a Mishkan was to take a world that is so profane, a world that is so obscene, a world that is so indecent and vulgar, and to infuse that world with a sanctity, with Kedusha. To take that world and make sure to saturate it with sanctity, with holiness, that embodies the Beis HaMikdash. That's what it is. Isn't that exactly what we're trying to recreate on Shabbos? The building of the Mishkan was the same thing that we're all trying to do on Shabbos. We have Sheishes Yimei HaMaaseh. We go out to work and we're totally involved in the world and we're doing so many different things. And then we take a break on Shabbos to remind ourselves, no, you have to infuse your entire life with Kedusha. And Shabbos is the day where we get energy for all the week. And it informs the way we make decisions throughout our lives. But that's exactly what the building of the Mishkan was meant to do as well. And that is the connection between Shabbos and the building of the Mishkan. There's an unbelievable Medrash Tanchuma in Parshas Pekudei, where the Medrash compares and parallels Briyas Shamayim Va'aretz to Binyan HaMishkan. The Medrash compares the building of the Mishkan to the creation of the world. And there are so many corollaries that you find in the Medrash. Number one, says the Medrash, on the first day of creation, what does the Torah say? Bereishis bara Elokim, es ha-shamayim ve-es ha-aretz. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. And the Torah says, note shamayim kayiria. HaKadosh Baruch Hu spread out the shamayim. Kayiria means like a piece of fabric. What does it say when we were building the Mishkan? Va'asisa yiriyos izit. That same word about yiriyah is the description of creating the world as we find by the building of the Mishkan. Second day of creation, Hashem says, yihi rakia. There should be a rakia, and vihim avdil ve'mayim l'mayim. It should separate between this part and the other part. Now, what are we told in the Mishkan? V'yivdila parot eslachem. We also have separations that are made, havdala, between one part of the Mishkan and the other part of the Mishkan, which our whole life is havdala. Our whole life is learning how to separate between this and that, between kodesh l'chol, between one category and another category, between understanding what we're allowed to eat, what we can't eat. The Medrash then goes further and says, on the third day, water was created, Yikavu Amayim. And in the Mishkan, what are we told? There's a focus on having a water spigot there where everyone's going to wash their hands and feet before they come in. Again, a similarity, as the Medrash says, between the Mishkan and Bria Shamayim Ba'aretz. On the fourth day of creation, we're told, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Ba'oros. And in the Mishkan, as we know, there was a menorah that lit up all the time, just like there was created a sun and the moon to light up the world. On the fifth day of creation, somebody told me in shul the other day, he was very excited about it, that there's going to be a green galaxy or something that's going to be seen this week. Anyone know what he's talking about? I don't know. He said that he spoke to a Makubal, and the Makubal said it's a Simon Yafes, so we should daven. I said, great, should always daven, whether there's green galaxies or not. Always a good thing to daven. If you believe in Mekubalim, now's a good time to daven. Something green outside, I don't know. Okay, on the fourth day it says that there were lights that were created, and the Medrash says in the Beis HaMikdash, the only way it was able to function was because we had a menorah that lit up the Beis HaMikdash. On the fifth day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created birds, and as we know, in the Mishkan, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us we should bring birds as karbanos. And also in the Mishkan, as the Medrash says, they were kruvim, parsei knafayim lamala. They were kruvim that had wings on them, which also reminds us of the birds as well. On the sixth day of creation, Adam HaRishon was created, and he was singled out to be unique and to be different and special. And the same way we have Adam HaRishon, so too, says the Medrash, we have a Kohen Gadol, who's singled out and unique, whose job it is to serve in the Beis HaMikdash at all time. On the seventh day, as we know, by Echul HaShemayim HaAretz, and in the Mishkan it says, Vateichal kol avoda, that everything was finished. The same Lashon, Vayichulu, Vateichal. And the Medrash goes on and on to have all the parallels between Bria Shamayim Va'aretz and this idea of building the Mishkan. The Or Gedalio, or Gedalia Shur, suggests, what is the connection between Bria Shamayim Va'aretz and the building of the Mishkan? Where he writes, the answer is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as we know, God created all matter. All time and space was created by the Ribono Shel Olam in Sheish Yemei Bereishis. Now, we are now given an opportunity to do something different. It's our opportunity now to create sanctity, to create a Mishkan. HaKadosh Baruch Hu put everything in the world. Now it's our job to take all of that and sanctify it. So there is an intrinsic connection, an inherent connection between Bria Shamayim Va'aretz and the building of the Mishkan. Because the function that we have in building a Mishkan is to take all that God put into our world, all matter, and to bring it to the next level. And that is why there is a direct correlation between all that the Mishkan represents and the beginning of Shamayim Va'aretz, when the world was created by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. Okay, so what we find is that there are many, many times where the actual definition of a melacha is going to be determined based on the way things were done in the Mishkan. So let me give a few examples. In the Yerushalmi, the Talmud Yerushalmi, there's a discussion. We have a melacha on Shabbos referred to as bona. You're not allowed to build. Now, what am I not allowed to build? Lego? What constitutes building? So I would say, building in the classical sense means you take bricks and you cement them. That's a building. Everybody agrees that would for sure be a melacha. What about something that's not as clear? Right? So I take a bunch of foam blocks and put them on top of each other. Everybody would agree that's not called building, because that you just knock over and it's gone. So what about all the gray in between, which is 1,000 different shades of gray in between? How would you classify and categorize those? So one question the Yerushalmi raises is, what if I have a binyan l'sha'a? What if I only have a temporary building that I'm building on Shabbos? Is that considered to be something that would classify as a malacha of bonet? Is that called building? Or do you say, no, if it's only temporary, that's not called building, and there would be no prohibition to do that on Shabbos? Major discussion in the Yerushalmi. Now I'll ask you, when is this relevant to us? Whoever builds something temporarily and then takes it down?
Tent.
What?
Tent.
A tent is a great example. What's another example? Maybe an example we're not thinking of is, in the 1800s, there was a big, big discussion between the Noda Yehuda and the Chasam Sofer a little bit later. They didn't live together, but they had a major discussion, 1700s, 1800s, about opening an umbrella on Shabbos. So am I allowed to open an umbrella on Shabbos? Or would you say, no, that's called building. No, but that's not called building. That's something that's already built that I'm just opening, but I'm going to take it apart right after. I'm just going to use it till I get to my destination, then I'm going to close it. So would that be classified, would that be categorized as called binyan on Shabbos or not? Assuming that I have an Erev, assuming that I'm able to carry it outside because I got around those issues of Hotzah. But we're talking about whether I'm allowed to open up the umbrella on Shabbos, right? So would that be considered a malacha of bona, a building on Shabbos, or perhaps not? That's the practical application for us. Or as you very correctly said, maybe pitching a tent on Shabbos. Great question. I'm only going to have it up there for a day or two. I'm obviously not intending for this to be a long-term solution. No one's going to live in that. So would that be considered a malacha bonev, or perhaps not? The Rishalmi has a discussion as to how we classify the malacha bonev, and the Rishalmi says, well, let's look back at the Mishkan. After all, the Mishkan, what was the story with the Mishkan? What?
Temporary.
It was temporary. Why?
Because they were moving.
They kept moving. Every time they moved, they took everything apart, and they put it back together. And then when they got to the next location, they built it again, took it apart, so they moved to the next place. So therefore, maybe we should define the parameters of this malacha abone, maybe should be defined by what we find in the original story of the Mishkan. And just like there, bone, binyan l'sha'a, when I did only a temporary building, it was considered to be a building. So too now, if I only do a binyan l'sha'a, maybe it should be a, maybe it should be considered a building as well. Take another example. Again, we're not getting into the specifics of each malacha. I just want to give examples to illustrate the point that we're making. Another malacha that we find on Shabbos is the malacha of hotzah. You're not allowed to carry outside. So the Gemara Masechta Shabbos, Daf Tzadi Gimel Amud Beis. Masechta Shabbos is a huge masechta. So Tzadi Gimel Amud Beis, the Gemara talks about the following. Hamotze Adam Chai Bemita. What if I take a live person on a bed and I carry them on the bed outside? So what would you say? Have I violated the malacha of hotzah or not? What?
With the bed or just the
oh, that's a good question. So let's say I carry a live person outside.
Yeah.
Would I be in violation of hotza or not? The answer that I should have said is, of course. If I take a paper clip and I walk outside of my house, I violate hotza. If I take a person who's 150 pounds or more or less, whatever, I should say, for sure, I violate hotza. Well, what should be the difference? Why should there be a distinction between taking a paperclip outside and taking a person and carrying them outside? So the Gemara introduces us to a new concept, which is hachai nosei es atzmo. Perhaps I should say that when you're carrying a live person, I'm not carrying dead weight. When I'm carrying a paperclip, I'm carrying everything myself. When I'm carrying a live person, maybe there's room to argue that the person, him or herself, is helping themselves to be carried. Obviously, it's much lighter to carry a live person than it is to carry an individual who is deceased. So therefore, the Gemara says that maybe there's room to argue that carrying a live person outside on Shabbos would not be a violation of Hotzah b'Shabbos. Now, Tosas there writes, on Maseches Shabbos, Daf Tzadi Dalet Amud Aleph, Tosas writes, the answer, the reason why it should be different is because if we learn all of the malachos from the Mishkan, did they ever carry live people in the Mishkan? No, everybody walked. The only thing they carried was maybe an animal from one place to another to bring a carbon, or maybe they were missing a screw somewhere, or maybe they have to bring a pan from one place to the next, or whatever it was. But there was nothing involved in carrying people, and therefore Tosa says, that's the reason why we should argue that the whole defining characteristic of the malacha itself, of Hotzah, is going to be determined solely based off of what was done in the days of the Mishkan. Which is very fascinating. It's not just that the category of malacha is defined by the Mishkan. It's the details of when we say the malacha applies or doesn't apply, or the circumstances of such, are also going to be defined and determined by what was done in the days of the Mishkan. Maseches Shabbos, Daf Ayin Daled. The Gemara talks about the malacha borer. What is the malacha borer? You're not allowed to separate two different items. If I have solas and ochel, I have part of the mixture that I like and part of the mixture that I don't like. Anyone here likes black jelly beans? It's always that one person. Always two. Always that one person. Okay, so I, along with 98.5% of us here, do not like black jelly beans, right? But you have a big thing of jelly beans, and you want to only eat the ones that you like. You don't want to have the other ones in. So what do? So there's a malacha borer on Shabbos. There are ways to do it, ways not to do it. Maybe we'll talk another time. But the Gemara does say, Maseches Shabbos, explicitly, that I'm allowed to be borer la'alter. If I'm about to eat these jelly beans now, I'm about to have dessert, and I want to eat them, so I'm allowed to pick out ochal mitoch psolas biyad. I'm allowed to take out the colorful ones that I like if I'm going to eat them right now. Why? But I'm separating. And the answer is, the Rashba explains in a tshuva, the Beis Yosef quotes the Rashba, the answer is because in the Mishkan, when they separated different items, they did it because they had a building project going on, because they had to build a Mishkan. So you have to separate the screws from the nails, from everything else. They have to separate whatever was needed for this activity that they were doing. But here, I'm not doing an act of separation. All I'm doing is achila. I'm doing an act of eating. The only way to eat this is if I have the thing that I want to eat in my hand. If I'm going to end up with a black jelly bean, that's not going to be conducive to my achila. And therefore, it's not defined as the same melacha because it's not being done in the same circumstances as the Mishkan was done either. Take for another example by Hutzah, when we talk about carrying on Shabbos. So it's clear in the Gemara that if you have a roofed area that's enclosed, that has a covering over it, that is not going to be considered a Rishus HaRabim. Even though it could be a huge football stadium and the whole thing is covered over, it's not a Rishus HaRabim. Why not? Why is that not called a public space? Because in the days of the Mishkan, the whole Machane Yisrael, the whole Jewish camp, was out in the open. They were in the desert. There was nothing covering over them, and therefore we assume that it's not defined as a Rishus HaRabim with regards to the Malacha of Hotzah, because in the days of the Mishkan, that's not the circumstances that they had. And that clearly defines how we do things today as well, which is why Rashi says, another characteristic is, it cannot be defined as a Rishus HaRabim. This is a very controversial point, but Rashi says that it cannot be defined as a Rishus HaRabim today, unless you have 600,000 people who frequent this area. Now you'll say, so then you never have a Rishus HaRabim, right? But if you have, let's say, Broadway, or you have very busy streets here, Fifth Avenue, where you have people driving all the time, and you have people passing through every day, you do have 600,000 people on some of these streets, and that's why, when it comes to building an Erev, you have to keep this in mind. But again, Rashi is drawing a parallel from exactly the circumstances that were in the days of the Mishkan, and figuring out whether or not it applies to our situation today as well. Any questions before we go further? Does that mean nobody knows what I'm talking about, or it just means that everything was clear? Hope everything was clear. If anyone has questions, don't be embarrassed to ask. Okay, the last thing that we're going to discuss before we finish is, again, these are all very important to try to understand as we go through certain malachos and certain prohibitions on Shabbos. To know the building blocks of how we came to where we are is very, very critical to have an appreciation for what it's all about. The last thing that we're going to talk about is, the Torah says in Sefer Shmos, Perek Lamed Hei, Pasuk Lamed Gimel, that Lasos Becham Aleches Machsheves. Everything that was done in preparation of the building of the Mishkan was very deliberate, was very intentional, was calculated, was for a specific purpose. And from there we learn that if a person does something on Shabbos, but it was not something that was a maleches machsheves, it was not something that was deliberate, it was not something that was intended to be so, then that is not considered to be a malacha on Shabbos either. So say, for example, if I do something shalo b'kavana, something happens, but it was not my intention at all. So we paskin like Reb Shimon that would not be considered a malacha on Shabbos. Now, it may be rabbinically prohibited anyway, but as far as the Torah is concerned, that would not be a malacha on Shabbos because it lacks this idea of malachas machshavas. Let me give you a great test case. The Gemara says in Maseches Baba Kama, the Gemara there is getting into a discussion about all kinds of damages. Somebody damages property. How much am I responsible? How much am I able to say this action or this damage had nothing to do with me? It doesn't relate back to me. Different parts of the detailed discussion there. But the Gemara there gets into the following scenario. What happens if you have somebody who lights a fire? I'm lighting the fire here and the fire is very contained. Everything's fine. All of a sudden, unexpectedly, we're not talking about a place where it's very windy. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's a tornado and the fire picks up. I mean, if you have a tornado, you have bigger problems. But you have a big wind comes out, picks up the fire, and the fire now moves to someone's property, someone's house, someone's field, or whatever it is, and the whole house gets destroyed. Am I to be expected to claim responsibility? I lit a fire, and everything was very contained, and everything was safe. And somewhere, out of nowhere, a wind comes and starts blowing the fire out of my control. And now somebody gets hurt or damaged as a result of what I did. There are times, says the Gemara, where we would say, again, under very specific conditions, I am not going to be held responsible. Why? Because you can't take that and say, this is what I did. This is not what I did. What I did was, I was a responsible person, I lit a fire. I have a right to light a fire. What happens if I have the stove on in my house? And suddenly a wind comes, smashes the window, out of nowhere, the fire from my oven, right? It's an extreme case, but the fire from the oven now, you know, flies outside and it catches onto a tree, which then, I mean, come on, how am I expected to be responsible for that? So the Gemara says, since the wind is really what took my fire to another location, and that's what caused the damage, you cannot relate it back to me. And therefore, I would not have to claim responsibility for the damage that was done. That's what the Gemara says. Okay, now let's plug that into Hilchos Shabbos. Ask the Gemara, is that really true? Which malacha on Shabbos requires wind in order for the malacha to happen? Zora. What's the malacha of Zora? Winnowing. Now, nobody knows what winnowing is. So what is winnowing? Right, so what do? You throw wheat up in the air, the wind comes, and it blows away the unwanted, and the heavier part of the wheat, which I want to keep, will drop down. So I ask you, how can that be a malacha on Shabbos? How can that be a malacha on Shabbos? What did the Gemara just tell us when it comes to Nezikin, when it comes to damages? If a wind comes and collaborates together with something that I did, we don't relay the activity back to me, and I won't have to pay. So if I don't have to pay, that means the wind has nothing to do with what I did. What I did is done. What the wind does is something else. And it's the wind's problem. It's not my fault. Now, plug that into our case. How can it be that there's a malacha on Shabbos called Zorea? Zorea. How can that... Zorea is planting, sorry. Zorea is winnowing. How can it be that I'm held responsible? How have I done anything wrong if I throw something up into the air, the wind then comes along, blows it out? How is that a malacha? How is that a prohibition? The answer is, what is my intention? What is my intention? And the Gemara answers, Meleches Machsheves Asra Torah. When we talk about Shabbos, what really matters is, what was my intention? My intention was, when I threw up the wheat into the air, my intention was that I expect and I hope that the wind is going to come and get involved in my activity and bring about the result that I intended for. When I light a fire, my intention is not that the wind is going to come and blow it out into someone else's property and destroy it. And therefore the Gemara says, since Shabbos is defined by meleches machsheves, by calculated and deliberate intentional acts, this would be included in meleches machsheves, because this is exactly what I had in mind. The Mishnah Berurah gives an interesting case. Mishnah Berurah quotes the Rambam. The Rambam says, we know that we have a melech on Shabbos of tzeda. What does tzeda mean? You're not allowed to trap an animal. Okay, so you can't trap an animal. So, what happens if I have the following? I have a tzvi, I have a deer in my backyard. And I'm so excited that there's a deer here, and I'm going to be able to have a deer skin, or I'm going to be able to put up a deer's head in my living room, show everybody that I captured a deer. Problem is, it's Shabbos. So I can't take out my however I'm going to kill a deer, I can't do that on Shabbos. And I can't go put my trap out to catch the deer either. So what do I do? But I'm so excited, I want the deer. If I wait till after Shabbos, it's going to be gone. So what's plan B? What do I do? What do I do? Anyone has an idea? So, this person comes up with a great idea. What's the good idea? He's going to scare the deer. Anyone ever drove and unfortunately hit a deer? No? Last summer, I was asked to go visit some of the Yachad summer camps. I was driving with someone, and we actually hit a deer. It was crazy. We actually hit a deer. Our whole front of the car was full of deer hairs. The deer actually died and rolled off to the side of the highway, and our car was fine. It was really a miracle. Yes, a tremendous miracle. But part of what they say is very dangerous about a deer is when it sees the headlight, right? When they say the phrase, you're like a deer in headlights, what does that mean, like a deer in headlights?
Freeze.
What?
Freeze.
What happens when a deer sees headlights? It freezes. Why? Why?
Scared.
Scared. It's not because the deer wants to hurt you. It's not because the deer is trying to defend itself, but because it gets scared. And when it sees something coming its way, it just stops. So here's the great idea. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to scare the deer. This way, by doing so, I'm going to have my dog be able to catch up with the deer and kill it. On a normal course of events, a dog would never be fast enough to catch a deer and kill it. It's impossible. But if I do something to scare the deer, like I throw something at it, or I shine a light, or I open a door, or I crack something, or whatever, make it nervous, make it scared, lahavhil et hatzvi, if I do something to scare it, and now my dog is going to be able to go and actually bite off the leg of the deer, and it will be stuck here for the rest of Shabbos, that would be a malacha tzeda. Says the Rambam, you would be chayiv for catching a deer on Shabbos. How could it be? I didn't put a trap out. I didn't do anything. I didn't kill the deer. What did I do? All I did was somehow scared the deer successfully enough that my dog was now able to catch the deer and pounce it. So what did I do? Imagine if my dog on its own is running around the backyard, sees a deer, happens to jump on it, and kills it. Am I in violation of anything? No, it's nothing to do with me. The dog did whatever it did. So why is it that when I enable the dog to be able to do that by scaring the deer, why is it that I'm considered to be someone who's in violation of the Melacha Tzeda? That's the question of the Mishnah Berurah. Mishnah Berurah answers, how do you explain this, Rambam? The Mishnah Berurah says, Shekein hu derech hatzayadim latzot. Because this is what hunters do. They're not fast enough to catch deer. I mean, I don't know, but he says they're not fast enough to catch deer. And therefore, the only way they can do it is to scare the deer and then come in a different way. So what you're doing now is melachas machshavas. My intention by scaring the deer is that I should be able to catch it. And that is why the Rambam paskins that somebody who does such a thing is in violation of the melacha of tzeda on Shabbos. Because that would fall under the category of melachas machshavas asra Torah. Just as everything in the days of the Mishkan was done with specific intent, so too, everything that's considered to be a malacha today has to be with intent and has to be a deliberate act. However, as we know, a person can then go and spend the entire Shabbos doing all kinds of things with a shinui. What does a shinui mean? Shinui means I do it differently than the normal way to do it. So that's not a melachas machshavas. That's not the normal way that it was done in the Beis Hamikdash, in the Mishkan. So I should say, yeah, there's no problem to use a computer on Shabbos. I'll just type with my knuckles. So you can be surfing the internet, and you can be watching all your movies, and you can be doing whatever you want. Everything on Shabbos is permissible as long as I make sure it's not done exactly like the Mishkan. Is that imaginable? Can we really believe such a thing? What kind of Shabbos would we have? That would be a pretty lousy Shabbos. I mean, some would say it would be a very exciting Shabbos, but it would be a terrible experience of Shabbos if we'd be allowed to do everything that we normally do just to do it with a shinui. I remember I was once in the hospital. Two of my children were born on Shabbos. So I was once in the hospital. My wife had a baby on Friday night. I went Shabbos morning to the shul, which was two blocks away from the hospital. And when I was coming back from shul, I was waiting in the little hallway there in the vestibule for somebody to come through the automatic doors. There was another Jewish guy who was there. And he looks at me and he says, why are you waiting? I said, well, you know, the doors are electric, so I'm just waiting for somebody to come through and I'll go. Now, people always go through because you have medical personnel that are going from one room to the other, from one floor to the next. Of course, there are people going through all the time, so I wasn't concerned that I was going to wait there all day. It would be a matter of a minute or two. So he says to me, what do you mean? Your wife is a chole. You should go take care of her. I said, you're right. My wife had a baby. She is a chole, but she's very well taken care of. And there's a medical staff that's far more qualified than I am to take care of her needs. And I don't think there's any heter to push the button on Shabbos. Anyway, he got very upset, very agitated. And he says, you know, do you know anything about Hilchos Shabbos? I said, actually, I do know a little bit about Hilchos Shabbos. And he says, well, you obviously don't. Why don't you shinoy it? So I said, what do you mean, why don't you shinoy it? What is that supposed to mean? He says, you know, like, just do it with the back of your elbow. I said, well, you're not just allowed to do anything on Shabbos with a shinoy. There has to be justification to do that. Midrabanan, rabbinically, we're not allowed to do any malacha with a shinui. So he says, you know what? You're really not following what the halacha expects of you. So let me make sure you're not going to be in violation. I'll shinui it for you. So he goes and pushes the button with his elbow. And I said, you know, that's a whole other shaila. Whether Yisrael she'asa malacha bishvil Yisrael. If you have a Jew who does a malacha on your behalf, whether or not you're allowed to derive benefit from it. Another further question. Anyway, the point being, we don't just allow a person to do anything with a shinui. That's not the way it works. The Torah does say that doing something with a shinui on Shabbos is not considered to be the malacha itself, but the Chachamim came along and said that there would be a prohibition anyway, because otherwise a person could go about the entire Shabbos doing whatever they wanted. So say, for example, the Gemara Masechta Shabbos, Daf Kuf Gimel says, what's the normal way for a person to write? Again, if you're a righty, is to write with your right hand. What if a person takes a pen with a left hand? It's not going to be neat. It's not going to be legible. It's going to be very hard to get a few letters out with a hand that you don't normally write with. Or the opposite, if someone's a lefty and they write with the left hand, and with the right hand on Shabbos, that would be a shinui. That would only be asur midirabanan. That would only be prohibited on a rabbinic level, because that would not be a malachas machshavas. That would not be the way things were done in the Mishkan, and therefore that would not be defined as a malacha as far as we are concerned. Say for another example, the Gemara says in Masechta Shabbos, Tadi Dalid, that the normal way to cut one's nails is to use a nail clipper, to use a scissors. Somebody bites their nails. The Gemara assumes to be that that's not normal. That's not the normal way to do things. Now, of course, there are people who do bite their nails, but that's not the norm. If you're one of those people, then that's a problem. It's interesting. The Chazon Ish said a story once that if a person bites their nails on any day of the week, they're a Mechal Shabbos. So they asked the Chazon Ish, why are you Mechal Shabbos? What does that mean? It's Tuesday. So he said, because if you bite your nails on Tuesday, it means you're going to bite your nails on Shabbos. And biting your nails on Shabbos is Chil Shabbos. So, interesting. So the Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos Tadi Dalet, cutting your nails with scissors or with a nail clipper would be a Malacha on Shabbos. Biting your nails would be a Shinoi. That would be the abnormal way to do so. That's what we find in Hilchos Avelos as well. If a person, an Avel, is not supposed to cut their nails during the Shloshim. However, if they bite their nails, that would not be prohibited because that's not considered to be the normal way for a person to limit the length of their nails. So the Gemara gives a whole bunch of examples of where we find that a person who does something in an abnormal way would not be in violation on Shabbos. Another example, the Gemara says with regard to Bishul B'Shabbos, it's quoted in Shulchan Aruch, if somebody is Mevashel B'Chama, I crack an egg, I'm in the middle of the Sahara Desert, I crack an egg, and I just leave it on the floor there, and all of a sudden it becomes a sunny side up, right? So how did that happen? It's because it's boiling hot. So it's boiling hot, and now I cook the egg. Am I in violation of a Malach on Shabbos? Gemara says, no, Mutu Lechatchila. Mutu Lechatchila, no problem at all to do that. There is no prohibition of cracking an egg in the burning hot sun and allowing the sun to cook it. Why? Ein derech bishul b'kach. Rashi says, because that's not the normal way for me to cook. Nobody cooks that way. So why would there be any problem? Moshe Feinstein is dealing with the question, but normally we say that a shinui is not permissible on Shabbos midrabanan. Right? Normally we say that on Shabbos, even though the Torah says if you do something in an abnormal fashion, it's no longer categorized as a malacha, but the Chachamim came along and said, you're not allowed to do that because otherwise we're not going to have Shabbos. So how come suddenly here, Bishul B'Chama, the Chachamim say, no problem, even the Chatchila is mutter. Why not? So Rav Moshe tries to deal with the issue to figure out why this would be different than any other case where we would generally say that a shinui would not be something that is permissible. The last thing that I want to talk about, I know I said the last thing was for the last thing, but here's the really last thing, is the category of Malacha Shein Tzricha L'Gufa. This is an important thing to understand. Malacha Shein Tzricha L'Gufa means in the Mishkan, when they did a certain activity, it was done with an intended goal or purpose in mind. What if I'm doing that very same activity, but without the same intended goal in mind as they had in the days of the Beis HaMikdash? For example, the Mishnah says in the 10th parak of Masechta Shabbos, if somebody unfortunately passes away on Shabbos inside of a house, so I don't want the body to be in the house, it's going to make the house smell terrible. So what should I do? Carry the body outside, right? Carry the body outside. Now, am I carrying the item, the body outside because I want it to be from place A, I want something to get from place A to place B? No. Most of the time when I carry something, it's because I'm building a Mishkan and I need a beam from this end of the room to get to the other side, so I carry it from place A to place B. That's Hotzah. But here, I'm not carrying it because I want it to be in place A or place B. I just don't want it to smell up the house. If I had another way to take care of that problem, I would be happy to do so. That is the discussion the Gemara has. In Machlokas, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, that's called a Malacha Shein Tzricha L'Gufa. I'm doing the exact same activity as was done in the Mishkan, but the intended purpose is totally different. In the Mishkan, when I did Hotzah, when I carried something from place A to place B, it's because I wanted it to move from place A to place B. Here, I don't care if it moves from place A to place B. All I want is that the house shouldn't smell. If there was a way to close off the room and make sure the house wouldn't smell that way, then I'd be happy to do that. But the only way to do it under these circumstances is to take the body out from the house and leave it outside. Would that be called Hotzah or not? That's what we call a Malacha Shein Tzricha L'Gufa. That's the big, big discussion. Take for another example. The Gemara says in Shabbos Daf Ayin Gimel, with regard to the Malacha of Choresh, so we know you're not allowed to dig a hole in the ground on Shabbos. However, says the Gemara, what if the only reason why I'm digging a hole in the ground on Shabbos is because I need some dirt? What's the normal reason why you dig a hole? It's because I want to plant something. I want to put something in the hole. But now, I'm only digging a hole because I want that which I'm going to extract from the hole. That's called a Malacha Shein Tzricha L'Gufa. I'm doing the exact same activity as is outlined in the Chumash. I'm doing everything that they did in the Mishkan, but for a totally different purpose. I'm not doing it because I want the hole, I'm doing it because I want the dirt from the hole. Is that called a Malacha on Shabbos? That's what we refer to as a Malacha Shein Tzricha L'Gufa. By chotzah, the Gemara gives, as the Shulchan Aruch talks about, a very common case. That's how you have a zav, a zava, or a nida, somebody who has some kind of emission from their body. I don't want my clothing to get dirty. So what should I do? So I put on a pad on my clothing that it shouldn't ruin my clothing. Isn't that chotzah? I'm carrying a pad on Shabbos. I'm going outside with something that is external to my body. So how am I allowed to do that? Shulchan Aruch says, no, because normally when I do chotzah, normally when I carry something from place A to place B, that's because I want it to go from place A to place B. But here, I don't care where it goes. If I had another way of keeping myself clean and making sure not to ruin my clothing, I would do that. But the only problem is I don't have another way. So I cover up that part of the body with some other external item, and I'm carrying outside, I'm doing exactly what the Gemara outlines and the Torah speaks about by chotzah, but it's for a totally different purpose. And therefore that's called, again, a melacha shein tzricha legufa. Here's a very common example, a very important one. Netilas neshama. Let's say I have a mosquito. Mosquitoes all over the place, or some kind of, I'm nervous about a snake or something. So killing the snake on Shabbos, killing the mosquito on Shabbos. What would you say? There's a melacha of netilas neshama. Not allowed to kill live animals on Shabbos. So what about killing a mosquito because I'm afraid that it's going to hurt me? It's going to damage me. It's going to do something negative to me. Would I be allowed to do that on Shabbos? That's called a melacha shein tzricha legufa. Why? Because in the days of the Mishkan, what was the reason, what was the intended goal of killing something? What was the goal? Either in order to eat it or to use its skin for some other purpose in the Mishkan. Here, I don't plan to do anything. I'm killing the snake because it scares me. I'm killing the mosquito because I'm afraid I'm going to get infected by it. That's a melacha shein tzricha legufa. That's a very common example that comes up. Or for example, another one. It's not for one day. But melechas tolesh, we know you're not allowed to detach something. Right? So what does tolesh usually mean? What does detaching usually entail? I see a fruit on a tree, and I take the fruit and detach it from the tree because I want to eat it. That's a melecha of tolesh. What they do in the Mishkan? They detach things because they needed to use them. They needed to use the herbs to be able to create whatever was necessary. That's tolesh because my intended goal is to use it for this purpose. So what about pulling out a tooth on Shabbos? Comes up all the time. No? People knock on my door with all these kinds of questions. So it does come up all the time. Just you may never have heard of it. So melechas tolesh on Shabbos. The normal classical tolesh is when I take a fruit off a tree, pick it off because I want to eat it. What about when I'm extracting a tooth, not because I want to do anything with the tooth, but because I just don't want it to cause the person pain? So you're doing the exact same activity as is outlined in the Torah. I'm doing exactly what they did in the days of the Mishkan, but the only difference is, why am I doing it? In the days of the Mishkan, I did it because I want the intended outcome, which is I want to use this item after I'm finished plucking it off from its source of origin. Here, the only reason I'm doing it is not because I want to use the tooth for anything, but rather, I don't want the person to be in pain by having this tooth in their mouth. That would be considered a malacha she'ein tzricha legufa. And we paskin like Reb Shimon, that one would be pater. But that's not considered to be the classical case of a malacha on Shabbos. So all of these are really preliminary discussions that we need to be aware of before we get into some of the more detailed discussions of the malachas themselves, which in Mirsa Hashem we will. But I think this introduction is something that is very, very important just to understand the categories and the exceptions to the rule, or where the rule actually originated from, which will make it easier for us as we go through specific cases to understand why or why not there should be a malacha at play when we talk about specific scenarios. Okay, wishing